The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and New Jersey, and everywhere our podcast will take us. I have a fantastic program lined up today. It's going to be Dr. Gerald Burke. He's basically a reproductive endocrinologist, which means that he helps gals with diseases such as premenstrual tension syndrome and premenstrual dysphoric disorder. They're a little bit different, and the gals need help. And Jerry is a guy who's been in practice 30 years, tons of experience. He's an expert in these two issues, which can turn people around. He will give you insight into why the cause, and he'll give you insight in how to treat. So if you have a fellow gal who has PMS-type symptoms, please tell them that if they're not on the line now, they can listen on our podcast after the show. Let me just give one quote to start off. It's better to know some of the questions than all of the answers, but I have a guest here today who can do both. That's Dr. Gerald Burke. He's been in practice for 30 years. He works in New Jersey. He has an incredible capability in the operating room, but more importantly, he's a very headsy type of reproductive endocrinologist who's going to give us some insight in the whys and how to fix things like PMS and PMDD. So, Jerry, thank you for coming on Inside Medicine today.
Joe, it's a pleasure to be here this morning. I'm really looking forward to discussing this topic and really helping to shed some light on it for the ladies out there who are experiencing symptoms and are really struggling with it.
Well, Jerry, so how about let's go with the definition to start, because you have a lot of information here that I have in front of me. What is premenstrual tension syndrome, known as PMS, which can be debilitating?
Well, what it really is it's a spectrum disorder, which is an emotional response to a hormonal imbalance. It is really not a psychiatric disorder at all, but it's a reflection of an imbalance between the estrogen and progesterone levels at various phases in a woman's normal menstrual cycle. And for women who are susceptible, they can go anywhere from being a little bit nasty to completely dysfunctional and unable to control what they're doing. These women are not crazy, and I think that's a very important thing that they have reassured about. Because this is, again, hormonal and is very treatable when you address it in that respect.
So I would say this, you're telling me it's not being nuts. It's called hormonal problems that a reproductive endocrinologist like yourself can identify and basically help these people fix that problem.
Right. The emotions are manifesting the hormonal imbalance. And what the women also have to realize is the treatments that work for psychiatric disorders don't work for PMS or PMDD. And things that work for PMS and PMDD generally don't work for psychiatric disorders as well. They're actually two separate entities that are going on. They just have the commonality of symptomatology.
So really, this is not something that the patient needs a psychiatrist. They need a reproductive endo like yourself who can make the diagnosis, because not everybody has the understanding of the hormones that you do. So can you just go back and say, what is premenstrual dysphoric disorder with the acronym PMDD?
What PMDD is it's PMS basically on steroids. This is a spectrum disorder where the milder forms are premenstrual syndrome. And these are cases where women will have some irritability the latter part of their cycles before the periods come on a monthly basis. They may have some depression, anxiety, that sort of thing. PMDD, on the other hand, is actually the one extreme of it. And in that situation, the individuals frequently are at times totally dysfunctional. They realize what they're doing, but they can't control it. And that can be flying off the handle. That can be crying, depression. It can be suicidal ideation. There's a whole gamut of things at the other end that really makes them dysfunctional and unable to carry out their normal activities of daily living.
So those poor gals basically have to pray for a period as soon as possible, every single day almost.
Yes. Once they hit it, they and those who experience it know exactly when they're hitting the times when they're going to have the symptoms. They really shut down, unfortunately. And it's really a hard way to lead life.
Okay. So this, it gets a little bit confusing, and you're the kind of guy who can make sure this is well described. What is the difference between PMS and PMDD?
Again, the key difference is the severity of the symptomatology. PMS symptoms or premenstrual syndrome are typically mild to moderate, whereas with PMDD, there's a marked greater severity in the emotional symptoms that significantly disrupts the person's social, personal, or occupational functioning. As a matter of fact, it's so severe that it is recognized in the mental health disorder manual, DSM-5, describes it and looks to characterize it and name it.
So that's not psychiatric. That's called pharmacologic, endocrinologic, see a reproductive endo. They're the guys who know the guys and gals who know the most about this. Did I get that right?
That is true. And the other thing too, if you're going to avail the services of a reproductive endocrinologist, you ideally want somebody who's not involved with doing IVF, because for most of the guys who get involved with IVF, that kind of consumes their whole lives. You're looking for somebody who's a reproductive endocrinologist who is not tied up with the in vitro fertilization aspect of the profession and is more focused on evaluating and treating hormonal imbalances in women.
Okay, so the fifth edition has indicated that PMDD is a distinct mental health condition under the category of depressive disorders. So it needs hormone fixing, not psychiatric medicine.
Yes, and again, that's one of the key things, that things that work for psychiatric disorders generally don't work for PMDD. Things that work for PMDD don't work for psychiatric disorders. The issue is when somebody has an underlying psychiatric disorder but gets premenstrual exacerbations. And again, I get a lot of patients referred in from psychiatrists who are seeing this in their patients. And my job is to take care of that premenstrual or pre-period exacerbation of their symptoms. And once we get a handle on it, it usually levels things out very nicely.
So is there a correlation where the woman's cycle is, say, in ovulation or before ovulation? Is that a tip-off for any of the gals?
Oh, most definitely. Ordinarily, you will not experience the symptoms of PMS or PMDD until after you ovulate and start to produce the hormone progesterone. It's the actual production of the hormone progesterone that tends to trigger it for most of these women. And the issue for most women is not progesterone itself, but it's inadequate levels. And if a person is predisposed to it with those particular levels, they can get extremely symptomatic. Other women aren't predisposed to it at all, and those and inadequate levels of progesterone won't trigger an issue with them. And as a matter of fact, those are frequently these women's harshest critics, are the women who don't experience it, because they tend to not have any real concept of what their colleagues are experiencing and are going through. And it's not something that's easily dismissed.
So, Jer, I mean, this can be a disabling diagnosis, but the problem is it's fixable. So do people know that they have PMDD? Is it common?
It's common. And again, about 75% of women will suffer from some degree of premenstrual syndrome. But when you get into the more severe aspects of it, about 3 to 8% of women will actually have PMDD, where the symptoms are actually affecting their ability to conduct their daily lives. And again, women will recognize something's going on, but frequently it's hard to convince anybody else that it's not a psychiatric disorder.
So basically, this occurs after gals are in their late 20s through early 40s. Is that correct?
That's when you tend to see it the most. And again, what it's reflecting is that these women are ovulating, but they're not, frequently many of these women are not ovulating as well as they had when they were younger, and their progesterone levels are in the second half of their cycle after ovulation are lower. And if they're predisposed to it, then they will develop it. But you can also get PMDD in anybody who is having cyclic fluctuations of their ovarian hormones and ovulating. That some of my most exasperated patients and families have been with young teenagers, 13, 14, 15, where the daughter, it's either me or an exorcist at that point because they've seen everybody else without any results. And literally the kids at that age will be breaking things at this part of the cycle, throwing things. It gets very bad.
Okay. Gerald Burke, I'll give you the phone number at the end of the program, but the answer is that PMDD is nasty. Let's just go a little bit deeper here. What's the underlying pathologic mechanism predisposing a woman to PMS or PMDD, the latter being the worst?
Well, Joe, the exact mechanism is not fully understood, but it's believed to involve an abnormal response to normal hormonal fluctuations, particularly the estrogen and progesterone in susceptible individuals. And again, I emphasize those who are susceptible to this. Neurotransmitters like serotonin play a significant role in PMDD. What you find is that there's two leading theories right now to the etiopathology of premenstrual disorders. The first theory proposes that there's a decline in estrogen levels in the late, what's known as luteal phase, or the second half of the cycle, when you're getting close to having your period come on, and that this may trigger or exacerbate a dysregulation of the serotonin system in the brain, particularly with serotonin transport. And this theory is supported by serotonin's role in the pathophysiology of other mood and anxiety disorders. And it's also supported by evidence of the efficacy of certain medications like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, as a treatment for premenstrual disorders. And the exacerbation of premenstrual symptoms triggered by depletion of tryptophan, which is the main precursor of serotonin. The second theory, though, is also equally interesting and may actually represent two separate subgroups of people. And the second theory suggests that the premenstrual symptoms may be related to the effects of progesterone and its metabolite, allopregnanolone, which is a neuroactive steroid that acts as a powerful agonist of the GABA-A receptors to enhance the neurotransmitters' calming effects on mood in the brain. Individuals with premenstrual disorders may have an increased sensitivity to the rise and the fall of the allopregnanolone in the second part of the cycle. And again, allopregnanolone is a conversion product from progesterone, the hormone progesterone. And allopregnanolone's role in the pathogenesis of PMDD is supported by evidence that administration of experimental agents that can stabilize allopregnanolone levels or modulate its activity are associated with an improvement in PMDD symptoms. There's also research to support that SSRIs can alter allopregnanolone levels, which may be an additional mechanism of action that explains the SSRI's rapid therapeutic effect in some individuals, even when administered when the symptoms have already had their onset.
I'm just trying to get my head around this. So is this a gynecologic hormonal case, or is this a psychiatric disorder, or is it both?
It's really both, Joe. And what you'll find is that some of your patients will respond very well to using an SSRI, such as Prozac. Other individuals won't respond at all. And when I have somebody who comes in who's on 90 milligrams of fluoxetine or Prozac without any results, I know that what's happened is the psychiatrist.
It's hormonal.
And then these are the ones who will particularly respond well to progesterone supplementation and whatnot. Ordinarily, if you're not getting a response with 20 or 30 milligrams of Prozac, it's probably not going to work for that particular individual.
So we don't need 80 milligrams of Prozac. We just need to rethink the differential diagnosis and come up to the conclusion. So So the question is there is all progesterones effective or affective in this disorder?
No, they're not, unfortunately, because what happens is most of your progestins, which are synthetic progesterones, have been altered in such a way that they will not be metabolized into the allopregnanolone in the central nervous system. That's the reason why when you're treating this with a hormonal basis with progesterone, you need to use the natural hormone. Using progestins like norethindrone and the like really won't treat the disorder directly.
So tell me what the goal is of using, getting that allopregnanolone lower is through what progestin?
The natural hormone progesterone is what you need to use.
So what if you go to the pharmacy and you prescribe that, what's the name of that hormone?
Prometrium is the commercially available brand of the natural hormone. And it comes in two sizes, 100 milligrams and 200 milligrams. And generally, that's the easiest way is to titrate those to the woman's symptoms when she's symptomatic. And again, that's something that we go back and forth on the telephone as she's symptomatic to adjust it for what her personal needs are. But you'll also find occasional individuals who need lesser amounts and will get sedated on those doses, in which case they have to go to a compounding pharmacy, and it can be compounded in doses as low as 25 milligrams. And we can usually work that out very, very well.
So I'm sitting here, obviously I'm not a reproductive endocrinologist, and how do I start out? I mean, if I can be as low as 25 and as high as, say, 400, and make sure that the pharmacist gives you the natural stuff, how do you ferret that out as a reproductive endocrinologist?
Well, if we're going to the point where they've generally, most of these people have gone through the use of the SSRIs without any success, and we're going to using progesterone supplementation, what I'll do is give them a prescription for 100 and 200 milligram tablets, usually 180 of each. And we'll start with the 100 milligram dosing. And what I'll have the person do is call me when she starts to get symptomatic. And then we have a PMDD treatment flow sheet that I have her filling out simultaneously with the date, the time, the symptoms she's experiencing with their severity, the medication she takes, and then how she is in 1 hour. And we will titrate this and just work with the progesterone, usually at 100 milligram dosage on an hourly basis until her symptoms resolve. And I caution the person that her symptoms are going to come back in 4 to 6 hours because progesterone only has a half-life of 6 hours. So you're going to have to redose yourself. If your symptoms don't come back, that means you're probably over the hump as far as this cycle is concerned, or at least for this day. But be prepared to redose. And if it takes us 300 milligrams the first time, if her symptoms start to return, you just take a full 300 milligram dose the second time and treat it like that. Again, looking to make sure that your symptoms are completely resolved within an hour's period of time when you'll have the adequate blood levels from that dose.
So I'm just kind of curious. So you have a disease that's incredibly disabling here for many women. And how much does this Prometrium cost?
It's covered by most insurance companies because that's the only natural form of progesterone that's commercially available through pharmaceutical firms. So the most insurances will cover it, whatever your deductible is for your insurance. When you go to compounding the medication, that's when I have a list of compounding pharmacies that I've had patients use over the years. And I have no qualms about having the patient call the different pharmacies and see what they're going to charge for it, because the compounding pharmacies will actually send you the medication too. So it doesn't have to be somebody that you have to be able to go to
their pharmacy.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So would you know what the average dose of 100 milligrams of Prometrium would cost somebody, or is there, you can't tell?
I don't know the cost of the commercially available because, like I say, it's covered by insurances. So whatever your deductible would be if you have a drug plan. Otherwise, it's not that expensive. It would be under $40 for the most part for individuals.
Okay. So gynecologists always seem to like to have thermometers at their bedside. So can I ask you, how do you play basal body temperature into this business?
Joe, I find, and this is, quite honestly, this is the reason why I actually developed not just an interest, but an expertise in this, is that with basal body temperature charting, which is a technique, it's where you take your temperature, a woman takes her temperature by mouth first thing in the morning before she gets out of bed to go to the bathroom or to chase the kids or anything, record it on a piece of graph paper. And what you can tell with that is you can tell if she's ovulating, when she's ovulating, and get an idea about the quality of the ovulations, because generally before she ovulates and produces the hormone progesterone, her temperature will be below 98 degrees. Once she starts to produce the progesterone, that causes the thermostat in her brain to go up about a degree, and so that it'll generally be above 98 degrees. And when you do that temperature charting along with the concomitant charting of the premenstrual or symptoms in the evening, so that you and chart it all on the same piece of graph paper, you get a very vivid picture of when symptoms start, where they is in the cycle, and what's going on. And again, what I like to do is ask women to chart the symptoms that are concerning them or bothering them on a scale of 0 to 4. 0 if they don't have it at all that day. 1 if they have it, and at its worst, it's mild. 2 if they have it, and at its worst, it's moderate. 3 if they experience the symptom, and at its worst, it's severe. And 4 if they experience it, and at its worst, it's disabling. And by disabling, I would mean if they, let's say we're going to go shopping that day, and they decide, no, I'm just going to hang out on the sofa today, that sort of thing, so that they're not able to conduct their activities of daily life. And when you compare, when you have these two in comparison, especially on the same graph to look at, the patterns become very clear very quickly. So that it makes it much easier to both diagnose, have a baseline to evaluate also your results of treatment, so know that if you're improving or not as you move forward. So it works very well.
So this magic of hormone progesterone, which is God-made, like, do the girls know exactly when that works? I mean, what's their response to the symptoms complex they have?
What will happen is, initially we have to titrate the medications based on their personal physiologic responses. And that's the reason why everybody has my cell phone number. I equip them with a PMDD treatment flow sheet, and things get tracked, and they will fill over with me when they have symptoms, and we will be working together. And what I generally find is that for most women, it takes about 3 cycles before they really fully understand, when they feel a certain way, this is what they need personally to take care of their symptoms. And so that there's a fair number of phone calls for those first 3 cycles. But after that, usually, unless they have a very unusual or aberrant ovulation in a given cycle, they take care of themselves fine. So that what I'll do is I'll see a person. I usually have a person make their first appointment after a month of charting, so that when they come in, I can sit down and go over it with them, and we can actually start to map out a game plan, a treatment plan. Then I'll see them back in 3 months and go over any details with them at that point. And most women are pretty much very stable at that level of time. And then I just see them on a 6-month basis after that. Because again, when you are taking hormonal medications, you do need to be seen on every 6-month basis.
That makes sense to me. So that's premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD. Pray you don't have it, but if you do, make sure that you get the natural Prometrium and make sure that you have somebody who understands that this is not psychiatric, it is hormonal. So let me just bring this up here. Is it important to distinguish between PMDD versus as being a psychiatric disorder, quote, wrong, or being a bipolar disorder, or being a PMDD? Is there a differential diagnosis to this symptom complex?
Well, there certainly is. And what's important about it is, again, the treatments that will work for PMDD in particular, and particularly if they're not responding to an SSRI like fluoxetine or Prozac, won't work for PMDD. And what works for PMDD won't work for psychiatric disorders like bipolar disorder or the like. And what you really need to do is sort those out. If there's ever a question, you can always use a medication like a GnRH agonist like Dipraglurant, which will completely shut the person's
progesterone
down, because it completely shuts down ovulations. It'll put them in a transient medical postmenopausal state where the estrogen and progesterone levels are all very, very, very low. So that it will not trigger the PMDD. And at that point, their underlying psychiatric disorder will be unchecked. And if they are still having symptoms, then you know that you let the psychiatrist know that he's got 6 months to work on it and get things together. Because usually you don't maintain people on a GnRH agonist like Dipraglurant for longer than 6 months because of other issues concerned.
So I'm just curious, what happens if you have the medication on board that's aggressive like this? Is there a secondary effect on bones or anything like that? Is there a significant issue using that drug?
Well, there can be. And that's one of the reasons why what I like to do is I like to use the once a month injection format for it. I always bring the person back for their second injection. And at that time, I draw two hormones, an FSH and an estradiol. And what I'm looking at that point in time is to make sure that I have indeed downregulated or suppressed the person's stimulation for ovulation so that they're hormonally in a postmenopausal state. At that point, we find out what symptoms they might be having from the low estrogen or the postmenopausal state. And if they're having hot flashes, night sweats, insomnia, palpitations, anything like that, I'll start them on some supplemental estradiol and titrate that level to an alleviation of those symptoms the same way that I would if they were postmenopausal and having the same symptoms. And what you'll see is because you're not producing progesterone, you're not getting the PMDD symptoms from it. And that's the reason why you'll take care of the other symptoms. And if they're still having depression and high anxiety levels and whatnot, that's when those are issues then for the psychiatrist to be able to hone in on directly.
So this is just shaking me up a little bit here, because the question is there's a lot of gals getting pellet therapy these days, which I've seen to be highly efficacious. If someone has PMDD, would pellet therapy intervention be the wrong way to go?
It all depends what particularly they're getting as far as the progesterone is in the pellet. A lot of the progesterone in the pellet isn't the pure hormone. It's a progestin. And again, that may well not be efficacious for the particular individual. And if a person does have the pellet therapy and is still having problems, that's an indication that she needs to go on beyond that to look into address her issues. The biggest problem with the pellets is that you tend to get frequently super physiologic levels of some of the hormones that are injected. And again, I don't want somebody to think that if I have progesterone pellets that should take care of it. If it does, great, but if it doesn't, don't get discouraged, because it's time to move on to the natural hormone.
Got it. Move on to the natural hormone. There you go. Where does Depo-Lupron come in this business?
Well, Depo-Lupron is really a very effective, what's known as gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonist, which actually shuts down the normal cycling mechanism between the brain, the pituitary gland, and the ovaries, and will put a person very effectively in a postmenopausal state. And the reason why that's important is because there's no question about progesterone being produced even in small amounts from the ovary, so that you can clearly get a handle on what's going on, and you can also get a clear handle on treating people even sometimes long-term with it. But if you're going to treat somebody long-term with it beyond 6 months, then you have to be concerned about issues like osteopenia or osteoporosis, which is thinning of the bones. And so that you want to get a baseline DEXA scan so that you know what you're starting with. And then again, usually if somebody's going to go on it long-term, I'll use some form of an anti-resorptive agent. Now, if they're on estrogen, I will use the estrogen itself is a very good anti-reabsorptive agent, but if they're not on estrogen, then I would want to use either bisphosphonate or something like that to help protect their bones.
Okay. So DEXA scanning is kind of very important for women to understand how important that is. And we also have to state that Medicare usually pays for that kind of radiographic study. And I would recommend anybody who's postmenopausal to get a baseline DEXA scan, or to take a look at your mother or your grandmother and see if they have that Dowager's hump where they're humping over. But if you have a family history, I think when menopause comes, I think you need a baseline DEXA. And then what happens is you repeat in 2 years and make a decision whether or not you're losing much bone, because nobody wants to get a little bit shorter pretty quickly. So in your practice, DEXA scanning, do you order that, or how do you work that out?
No, I'll follow people with DEXA scans. It's really important. I just wanted to re-emphasize the point that you made, because what people don't realize is that every 1 in 8 people who suffer an osteoporotic hip fracture will be dead within 3 months, either as a direct result of the hip fracture or as because of secondary issues that were created by the hip fracture, like bed sores and the like, and people becoming septic. And what people don't realize is the 7 out of 8 that survive the 3 month period of time in the hip fracture, they don't all return to full normal mobility. A lot of times they end up with canes and walkers and the like, so that it's a problem that's much more important to try to avert it rather than to fix it. The ounce of prevention with osteoporosis is more than worth the pound of cures.
Got it. And I do want to point out that there's more than one DEXA scan out there. And so whatever DEXA scan you start with, you're supposed to maintain that and kind of get that every 2 years in your menopausal life. And basically, if you develop that minus 2.5 osteoporosis, it's time to get treated, and that treatment is available, and we've got tremendous gains in that. Usually the rheumatologists are into that, the endocrinologists are into that, but remember, it's every 2 years, get it 2 years and a day so you don't get a bill, because if you're 2 years, sometimes the insurers want to send you a bill. Usually it's covered, and the medications that we can use to help bones is actually fantastic. Some of it's once a week, some of it's once a month. Some of it, it's every 6 week injection. And I would say this, that Medicare has been kind enough, despite the cost of that drug, to pick it up every 2 years for a woman until their osteoporosis has been turned around and is now within normal limits. So hats off to Medicare in this business of getting bone densities, and very, very helpful. And it's nice to have people who, how come they call up and ask you, how come I'm not having fractures anymore? Because basically they were getting just fracture after fracture. And once you get that medication in, fantastic benefits. So I'm very happy with DEXA scanning and Medicare for the postmenopausal woman. So let me just move forward. How about physical symptoms associated with PMS and PMDD?
A lot of women will experience physical symptoms, which are rarely a result of the hormonal changes between and imbalances between the progesterone and the estrogen. The most common ones are fluid retention and hormonally based fluid retention. They tend to get breast tenderness, lower abdominal bloating, swelling in the hands and fingers, and maybe a little bit in the ankles. And again, it's very common. Progesterone's natural activity is as a mild diuretic. Estrogen's natural activity tends to cause you to retain fluids. And when your ovulations are getting a little bit off so that your hormone production is not what you're used to, you'll see these issues as well. And they're very easily taken care of with the mild diuretic when you need it, and makes the person much more comfortable. I find that most people who do ask for treatment usually have a weight shift of about 5 pounds or so between the latter part of their menstrual cycle and when their period comes on, my experience. The other thing is that a lot of women have, or a fair number of women will have, are going to be headaches with their menstrual periods or menstrual migraine headaches. And what the mechanism of action of this is that outside of the brain, estrogen causes the blood vessels to dilate slightly. So it actually drops your systolic and diastolic blood pressure a few points. Inside the brain, estrogen keeps the blood vessels constricted. And if your estrogen levels in the brain are not as high as it's used to seeing, that will permit the blood vessels to dilate and swell, and you'll get either a menstrual headache or a menstrual migraine headache. What happens is that, again, some women will get menstrual migraine headaches even every cycle. And the easiest way to address that is to just supplement them with a little bit of supplemental estradiol, the natural estrogen. I like to do it orally. If they know when they're going to get the headache, I'll ask them to start it a day beforehand. If not, I ask them to start at the first signs of the headache. But I've had individuals, even with the full-blown headache, that it'll go away by treating them with some supplemental estradiol. I usually give it in 1 milligram amounts and titrate that on a 30-minute basis till the headache's gone. And most people, the headache will be gone within 1 to 3 tablets.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Jerry. How often does that occur? Because this is kind of new to me. So I'm glad you're here.
The menstrual migraines, first, you got to ask about most women about it. And I know that's one of the questions I ask all new patients, and certainly if they're here for PMDD, because we already have evidence of the fact that they've got some ovulatory dysfunction. So they've got some going to be more predisposed to hormonal imbalances. And the two main hormones are estrogen and progesterone in the ovulatory cycle. I would say that it probably occurs in about 5% of women, five to 10% of women. And the reality is, if now they got to be menstrual headaches and not randomly throughout the cycle, because if they're randomly throughout the cycle, that would be a different etiology that's working. But if you get the menstrual headaches, particularly the menstrual migraine headaches with Rs and everything else, they respond fabulously well to that. And it's almost surprised me that the neurologists really don't use this and don't really seem to be too privy to it. And perhaps it's because they feel uncomfortable using hormones as far as therapy is concerned.
Well, again, that's another reason why you're in reproductive endo. So do you want to just renew that? What is progesterone? Is it, it's a natural what?
Progesterone has a natural diuretic effect. And that's the reason why, particularly for people with PMS and PMDD, they're going to tend to have the fluid retention with the breast tenderness and the lower abdominal bloating, where even at times they'll change full size in their pant size and all because of the waist. Supplementing with progesterone will help that, but the easiest way to do it is just use a mild diuretic like hydrochlorothiazide on an as-needed basis.
So you're an HCPZ guy. Is it 12 and a half you use or 25? Or
I'll usually give the person a prescription for 25 milligrams, and I'll tell them you can take up to two twice a day if you need to. And rarely does that not do the job for them. But I have them start, you know, if you're not symptomatic, you don't take it. If it's symptomatic, it's mild, you take 25 milligrams. If that does a job for you, that's fine. That's all you take that day. If it doesn't, you diuresis yourself a second time with another 25 milligrams. If 25 twice a day doesn't do it, you can go up to 50 twice a day. And again, rarely is there anybody that 50 twice a day won't do the job for them.
Okay. So if the belt goes out, think about hydrochlorothiazide.
Most definitely.
Okay. So let's just try and renew this here. So what are the treatment options for PMS?
Well, PMS, of course, is the milder form of the disorder on the spectrum of this disorder. And things people want to be aware of with PMS is regular exercise, and do it. Exercise will be age appropriate for you in terms of, you know, where you are in your life cycle.
So you don't want them kicking soccer balls?
Not if they're 65 or if they're 50.
Okay.
Balanced diet, same thing. You want to eat a balanced diet that's not going to be adding to fluid retention, things like that. And the third thing is that you get adequate sleep. And most people, that's, you know, a teenager is going to be 8 to 10 hours a day. But for most ladies, it'll be 7 to 9 hours a day, 7 to 8 hours a day. It varies from person to person, but there's no point in putting yourself behind the eight ball because of inadequate sleep, diet, or exercise.
So how about when the young gals, you know, come to your office, what do you recommend for the young gals? Are they going to be doing push-ups or anything like that?
No, for the most part, with the younger ladies, they are going to be doing things that are enjoyable and social, like dancing, team sports, like soccer, or basketball, swimming. All these not only are great exercise, but they help to maintain their engagement with their peers and all as well, so that they're not being isolated.
Okay, I think they're going to have to come up with different age groups to play soccer and that kind of business for this hormonal issue. So you're saying that basically if they get 30 minutes of moderate exercise 5 days a week with 2 days of strength training, that they're going to be in great shape.
Yeah, and similar recommendations are for the other age groups of women too. And it's just a matter of really staying with it and all.
Yeah, because I hear you seem to also recommend yoga. Any comments on that?
Yoga is one of the mysteries of life to me, to be honest with you, that it works so well because women seem to enjoy it. People get great benefits from it. And I recommend that based on the reports I get from my patients.
Yeah, it's almost like when the girls get together in an exercise class that all of a sudden everything gets better. So that's fantastic. So let me just roll here a second. Just want to, let's just go up. What are the treatment options then for PMDD? Because we need to get to that.
Yeah. For PMDD, the first line of treatment is generally going to be a systemic serotonin reuptake inhibitor or an SSRI or an SNRI.
So you're doing your differential diagnosis to see what the case, what's the cause.
Right. And what will happen is, what you're going to find is that for many people, up to as many as 60 to 70% of women, an SSRI will help and I won't see them. But again, my experience has been that if you're on fluoxetine, which is a generic of Prozac, if you're going more than 30 milligrams, you generally, my experience has been, you generally aren't going to get much of an effect. And I frequently will see ladies coming on 70, 80, 90 milligrams a day. And I let the psychiatrist wean them off because I don't feel like having somebody have a serotonin syndrome, which is a withdrawal effect from the higher doses of the SSRIs. But, you know, that's your first line medication. And if that works, that's great. And you don't have to see somebody like me.
So 20 or 30 milligrams a day, that should do it.
Yeah, I usually start them with 10 milligrams.
Okay.
And then we'll titrate it up again because they'll be touching base with me and letting me know how they're doing while they're symptomatic. And generally, once you hit a dose that works, that'll maintain them through subsequent cycles. But other therapies that are frequently used are oral contraceptives, but and the most common one these days is Jazz. But the issue with oral contraceptives is they work because they're suppressing the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis or suppressing the stimulation of the ovary so that you're not getting any progesterone production. The problem is, and for the people that won't work on, it's because their stimulation from their pituitary gland to their ovaries is stronger, and they'll get some stimulation of the ovaries and some progesterone production that will trigger in those individuals the PMDD symptoms. So that's why for some women, oral contraceptives work like a charm. And that's one of the things that a lot of general gynecologists will put people on, and with good success. But when that's not working, that's when you got to start to go from a medical perspective into the other issues that are available, like supplemental progesterone, like your GnRH agonist and the like. But you also, other activities that will help, lifestyle modifications will help, and sometimes cognitive behavioral therapy and dietary supplementation with calcium and magnesium and vitamin B6 may also help. But again, by the time I get to the individuals, usually they're beyond the point where none of these have worked. And then we start looking at either treating with supplemental progesterone or using a GnRH agonist like the Depo-Lupron.
Okay. So it sounds to me like there's a lot of ways to go in this business, and you need somebody who's really can be the captain of the ship to know which way to go.
Oh, yeah. And that's so important, because what I find most discouraging, and it's sad, but it's human nature. A lot of times, times when women come in to see me, they've been through the ringer a few times and they're kind of exhausted. And in order to really help many of these individuals, you need them to hang with you while you actually work through each thing individually in a systematic way until you can optimally fine-tune their internal hormonal environment. And that's one of the places, again, where a GnRH agonist like Depo-Lupron can be very helpful, because you can use it diagnostically to shut the person down completely, to be sure that you're dealing with the PMDD and not an underlying psychotropic disorder. Also, it can give you a good idea about the extent of their symptoms that are actually PMDD, because they will disappear. And then it can be used therapeutically with a six-month treatment course. As we talked about before, when you start to get beyond 6 months, you start to run into the other untoward effects of the low estrogen state, which is where you need your DEXA scans and be conscious of your bone mineral density, and you move into a different phase of treatment. Also, one of the issues is that beyond 6 months, a lot of times insurance companies won't pay for it, and it's about $1,600 a month for a shot, so it's not cheap.
$1,600?
Yes, it's not cheap, unfortunately. The other novel therapies, which I'm starting to look into, are even considering, I will find an occasional woman who will suffer with PMDD, and you'll do the basal body temperature charting, and you'll start to see that she's got symptoms in the first half of her cycle. And she says to me, I say, that these can't be PMDD symptoms. And she'll say, but they are. They're exactly what I have all the time. And when you check a serum progesterone level on them, you'll find that even though they've not had an ovulation yet, their ovaries have been kicked into a small degree of progesterone production. And usually when the blood levels get up, for many people, when they get a blood above 3 nanograms per milliliter, they'll get symptomatic. And these are individuals that are actually having a very disorganized, dysfunctional ovulation. And one of the things that I'm looking to do with these individuals is consider using some ovulation-inducing medications with them to try to organize and coordinate their ovulatory function, and so such that you're not getting that early release of progesterone in the follicular phase. And so that's something that's on the horizon.
Okay. So do you want to just review that allopregnanolone and the CNS?
Right. With the central nervous system, with the allopregnanolone, progesterone gets converted, the natural hormone progesterone gets converted to allopregnanolone. The synthetic progestins don't get converted to it. And that's one reason why birth control pills in and of themselves don't supply an adequate amount of precursor for allopregnanolone to have that develop. But what happens is it's a powerful agonist for the GABA-A receptor to enhance the neurotransmitter's calming effects on mood. And these individuals with premenstrual disorders will have an increased sensitivity also to this rise and fall of the central nervous system hormone allopregnanolone in the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. And what they are experiencing is a withdrawal effect to it because the levels aren't as high as what their brain's used to seeing. And this leads to the symptoms of anxiety and depression. And this is also the reason why you have to titrate the progesterone to the individual's requirements, and it's not one size fits all.
Okay, got it. So it's important to make sure that people know PMDD is not really a psychiatric issue. It's hormonal.
Correct.
That's important. Okay. And what about somebody who decides, I just have to get rid of my ovaries because it's just driving me crazy? Do you get that? You get that issue?
You do. And what I see is that particularly if somebody has been very symptomatic and they go on the Depo Lupron, and you're coming to the point where, it's not going to continue to be available to them.
Because of cost.
Believe me,
$1,600.
Yes, because we can manage the other things, but because of costs, there are people who will say, "I would like to consider having my uterus and ovaries out." And the issue is, as far as that's concerned, if you take the ovaries out and leave the uterus, and you have to give the person supplemental estrogen because of hot flashes and night sweats, then you're caught with
rocking a hard place,
right? Because unopposed estrogen or taking estrogen chronically will stimulate the lining of the uterus to develop, and it can, for some people, go through a series of steps that leads to uterine cancer. And the ways to get around that, you have one of two options, basically, if you have a uterus in place and you're giving unopposed estrogen to take care of hot flashes and night sweats. One is that you, once every 3 months, give them a synthetic progestin for 12 days and withdrawal bleed them like Provera and hope that you don't trigger their PMDD symptoms. Problem is you may, and that can be a problem. The other issue is you can do an endometrial biopsy for them once a year to screen them for endometrial hyperplasia, which is a precancer step that can will develop on the way to cancer if you're taking unopposed estrogens. So that those are two options there if you leave the uterus. If you take the uterus out, then obviously that's not an issue, and the individual can just be treated with estrogen alone.
So unopposed estrogen is a problem.
Unopposed estrogen with a uterus is a problem. There's no question about that. And again, the reason for retaining the uterus would be if you wanted to consider using donor eggs or donor embryos at some time in the future, which without the uterus, of course, you would not
going to make it.
Wouldn't do it.
Yeah. It's getting pretty complicated.
It is. And it's a lot to talk about, a lot to think about. One of the considerations, and I've had individuals as young as the age of 35 say, I want my uterus and ovaries out because I have an underlying severe psychiatric depression and I don't want to take a chance of passing my genes on. So I wasn't going to have kids anyway for that reason. But that's a big decision. And trust me, we all agonize over that. I mean, if somebody's 45, that's one thing. If they are younger in their mid-30s, that's a whole different issue.
So when the young teenager comes your way, do they all of a sudden or all frequently walk in with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder? Do you see that?
Frequently.
Frequently.
Frequently, because what's happened is usually by the time I get the opportunity to see a teenager, they usually have seen 4, 5, 6, 7 other doctors, including a number of psychiatrists. And everybody's trying to treat them with what they have to offer them. And that's an easy thing to tag the kid with. And the reality is you treat them with either if they don't respond to the fluoxetine and an SSRI, you treat them with the progesterone, and all of a sudden their symptoms go away. And what you find with the teenagers is as their normal internal ovarian cycling mechanism matures with age, as they get through their late teens and early 20s, their symptoms go away. And all of a sudden you then you don't see them at all. But they are going to be predisposed to the same situation when they hit the latter part of their reproductive lifespan and when they get into their 40s and all. So that you want them to be aware of that, so know that if they start to experience these symptoms, that they know it's time to seek treatment again. You know, it's funny, Joe, one of the most interesting patients that I had the opportunity to see was a young lady that I always ask them, you know, what you do for a living? She says, I go to college. I say, where do you go? I go to Oxford. I said, what are you doing there? I'm on a Rhodes Scholarship. Turns out that she couldn't afford to lose 3 or 4 days a month because they go so fast and it's such an intense educational experience that she needed to be treated.
She needed help.
And she didn't need even 100 milligrams of progesterone. She did fine on 50s and really went well.
So how many times does somebody knock on your door indicating they have difficulties with maintaining relationships, maintaining employment, and doing daily responsibilities? How often do those type of patients knock on your door?
Those people will be here about 3 to 8% of the patients with PMDD will be having those things. It's a real issue for these folks, and it's a tragedy because they're good people, but their lives are such a mess because during the period when they're experiencing the symptomatology of the PMDD, they know what they're doing, but they can't control it. And afterwards, they think that's the dumbest thing I ever did. But you don't have the ability to control it, and you have to they suffer the consequences for it, which is loss of jobs, spouses, the whole nine yards. Yeah.
So, Jerry, we're coming to the end. We didn't get fully through this RX plan that you had.
Yeah.
But tell us, how does people get in touch with Jerry Burke?
Well, the easiest way is either through my website at GeraldBurkeMD.com or by our phone number, which, you know, calling our office, which is area code 856-429-2212. Those are by far the easiest ways of getting in touch with us. And, you know, if you are coming from a distance, you have lots of company because tragically, I mean, I have people who will drive 5 hours each way to see you. I have people that fly in, and it's always such a tragedy because they're not doing it because they enjoy long car rides,
they need help.
They're that desperate, and it's a sad situation. It really
yeah.
is. And the problem, and the thing is, you can help them, and they really restore them to a normal lifestyle.
So, what am I going to call this visit today to Inside Medicine for a title for our podcast?
I kind of like PMDD 2025, a clinician's guide to diagnosis and management.
Okay, you're going to write that down so I can get it up for the podcast. Okay, so again, podcast, www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine. There's about 75 different programs up there. Hit Inside Medicine. And Dr. Burke's podcast will be up later today, and it'll stay there for a while. There's about 125 up. Please hit the podcast. As tell your friends if you have somebody who has these difficulties that we talked about, and there's only one Jerry Burke that I know of. So don't forget to check him out, and he did give his how to get in touch with him on the podcast. So it's Dr. Fallon saying thank you very much. Jerry, I just want to end up with, it's better to know some of the questions than all the answers. And I think that's basically what you came up with today, how complex this is and how gals are having a hard time getting the correct care. Somebody who is incredibly well experienced in this, and somebody who's been around the horn, and somebody who is board certified like Dr. Burke. I also want to point out that Dr. Burke also has a JD degree. So this is a guy who loves being educated and helping his patients. So, Jared, any other comments that you want to make in 30 seconds?
Just, Joe, that it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to bring this information to the public in general, but particularly the ladies who are experiencing problems with it. And those who aren't experiencing problems, but are experiencing with it personally, directly, but are experiencing
not diagnosed.
Yes, the secondary problems of having a lady in their life who's irrational at times.
Right. So, Inside Medicine, www.wwdbam. Check out Inside Medicine. Check out Dr. Burke's podcast. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week. Inside Medicine says, have a Merry Christmas. Thank you, Dr. Fallon.